Good afternoon. How are you? Perfect example of something that we're going to discuss with Hoshana Rabbah. Sunday is happening in the camp right now, or has in the last 20 hours or whatever with the rain and so forth. I elaborate a little bit on that Sunday, but I did want to mention before we begin, we're going to be talking about Halakha and Agadah, two familiar terms to some of you, may not be so familiar to some of you. And I just wanted to thank, I wanted to take the time, I don't know if Lee's in the room here, but particularly the last two songs that the worship team sang today really ministered to my heart, the idea of the second to the last one, the idea of just being a reasonable, decent human being in life. Okay, and that was kind of expressed through the second to the last song and then the beautiful last song as well, because that's really what my message this morning or this afternoon is all about, is the natural way the Father has done things since the beginning, not starting in this book or starting in that book, but from the very beginning, He's always worked the way His creation works, and that He always starts with this first. And I want to take the time to encourage also your young people, since we just saw them dance up here. Some of you know my heart with the young people. These are the most important guys, my friends. This bunch that was up here. We need to encourage them and support them and be behind them and teach them and training for what I think, whether Messiah comes next week or not, what I think is a period of time in history that will be the most God-hating culture of all time. And primarily because of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil we call the internet. And because it's become a part of our lives, and as some of you well know, you may not all agree, it's running our lives, and it's only going to get worse. And I think we need to be preparing those young people to be able to, as the scriptures say, give an answer to every man that asks them the reason for the hope that is in them. And too many times today we can't give reasons for that. We know a lot of details about this, that, and the other. We figured out certain conjunctions of the moon. We figure out calendar dates right. We get the name right. We say this right. And then the kids go home and their neighborhood friend says, "How do you even know there is a God?" And they vapor lock. You know, they can't give an answer. A lot of people can't give an answer to the simplest of questions. And so I want to encourage, I don't know what the, Mike, I don't know what the cutoff on the age groups are, but I would encourage you, if you have young people here, whatever the age limit is, 13 to whatever, I hope it's 13 to 60, but I want to encourage you to send, I want them to be to all the teen gatherings, but particularly the next 2 days in the morning, because it's my opportunity to deal with a group of people that I love so dearly, and I want to be so dedicated to. Not that I want to appreciate you old people, okay? But I knew I'd get some kind of response to that. But to focus on these people, we're going to talk about not only how the scriptures have already told us all the things that we're discovering as the seals of Daniel have actually been opened, in my opinion, Daniel chapter 12. We're going to talk about the relationship of the scriptures, the Hebrew language with dark energy and dark matter. We're going to particularly focus on the God particle, otherwise known as the Higgs boson. Some of you may be familiar with that. So we're going to talk about Hebrew and particle physics. Now you may think, what? Okay. But when you hear the presentation of how the language works and how the particles in our universe that our language created, by the way, this beautiful language put in the universe, then that'll make a lot more sense to your children and your young people, and they can begin to defend the scriptures as not just some sort of book of religious doctrine and rituals and ceremony to give to a certain group of people so they look different than everyone else, but that our God truly is smarter than we are. And He truly is infinitely smarter than all the so-called scientists stacked on top of one another. And we need to give our young people the confidence to be able to go out into the world and know that they know that they know that they know that. That this is not just a religious experience. Okay, back to the purpose. of all this. Let me make sure I've got myself turned on. Or this turned on. I don't know if I know how to turn on myself. Anyway, we're going to talk about Halakha and Agadah. I want you to remember this passage up here because I think it's the quintessential example in the New Covenant Scriptures about what our Father teaches from Genesis chapter 1 only. And it's not only what He teaches in Scripture from Genesis 1 only, but we see these things in the natural creation in the universe as well, because His Word, as I said, created those things. And so that we have a like kind going on. Once again, the reason why the creation is designed is because the Word that created it is by design. And so we see these things being consistent from beginning to end. Paul did not say, "Be ye followers of me." He teaches over again that he's following Yeshua. Yeshua told us to take up our tree, that's what I believe it was, and follow Him. And so regardless of what all these various kinds of theology back and forth arguing, everybody giving 100 points in a poem and so forth about this theology and that, I am following my Messiah. I'm going to do what He did. That's just the bottom line for me, because as some of you well know, the world of theology can be rather confusing, can't it? Okay? And the gazillions of voices that have now been added to the mix because of the internet. Because when we were young, basically all we had was our local church, CBS, NBC, ABC. And if you had enough tinfoil, you could pick up the Lutheran Hour on UHF. Okay? And that was really the only sources we had. We could go down to our local library, and that was dependent upon donations from the town and so forth. But I want you to keep this in mind as we move on to a concept that I hope will show the background of why Paul said a lot of the things that he did. Now, this is just my Rico imitation. Lucy. Okay, anyway. Some of you know what I mean. The other ones are scratching your head, I'm sure. There it is. I want you to find these two terms, Halakha. And I'm going to get as much as I possibly can here. I'm going to not be able to do it in detail. That's what the series is all about, is to get into the details. But we'll do as much as I can. When you look into your modern script of Hebrew, in your Chumash or whatever, you're going to see the background or the base of this word is up the top of your screen. Hey, Lamed, Kaf, Hey. Hey, Lamed, Kaf, Hey. That is Halakha. If you're Ashkenazic, if you're Sephardic, okay? If you're Ashkenazic, it's Haleka, okay? Or Laka, okay? And so the accent is on a different syllable, but it's the same word. And if you look it up in a Strong's Concordance, now remember, a Strong's Concordance is a what? A concordance, okay? Too many people use it as a dictionary. And it is a concordance. And there's a specific reason why Mr. Strong in the late 1800s developed this. And that's why he called it a concordance. But if you don't know Hebrew and Greek, you've got to start with something like a Strong's Concordance if you don't know the language. But trust me, it is downstream. If we can compare the language of our Bible as a river and so forth, the Strong's Concordance is downstream. You got to start there, but you just don't want to stop there. You want to continue to go upstream to the mountaintop, which is where the Torah was given. For example, you want to go to the mountaintop where the water, the words, are fresh and pure and pristine and full of oxygen and energy and actually good to drink. The problem is, in the beginning when this was given, as time went on and the water went down the mountain into the valleys, people came along and dumped stuff into the stream. And they fish the life out. They dump stuff in. They fish the life out. And by the time the water gets down to, if you will, the Gulf of Mexico, what does it look like now? You know what it looks like. It's brown, it's thick, it's yucky, and it's no good to drink anymore. Same water, but stuff, that's what we say in Hebrew. We don't say stuff. We say stuff has been added to it. And so the idea of that, and I believe the Father does this with every generation, but particularly this generation, He's restoring all this. This is what the ministry of Elijah is all about. That's why the most popular song in the world in the last 20 years, the most popular religious song in the world in the last 20 years is "These Are the Days of Elijah." It's been the most sung song in the last 20 years. It's not a coincidence that just for a time such as this, all of a sudden we're singing a song about restoration, about restoring all things. These are the days of Elijah. And my friends, not having time to lecture on it necessarily, I'm going to propose to you that we are Elijah. We are Elijah. We are the ones, according to Isaiah chapter 58, verse 11, are the repairers of the breach and the restorer of paths to dwell in. It's us that is doing that. The question is how to restore, how to repair these things. And so we have this concept of halakha. I get off on what my friend Bill says, rabbi trails, obviously. But if you look it up in the Strong's Concordance, it gives you some abstract definitions. It means to walk, to go forth, away, or to follow. Now, we haven't taken it upstream yet. We're still downstream. So it doesn't mean that that this word doesn't mean those things. I want you to understand what I'm saying when I talk about the concrete meaning of words and their natural means in the beginning. Because when you read the beginning in Scriptures, You do not read symbols. You do not read metaphors, similitudes, or figures of speech. When you read the opening chapters of Genesis, what do you read about? How many times have you heard me say this? The birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. That's how things start in the Scriptures. And I'm going to give you plenty of rabbinic quotes if we have the time that say the same thing. You cannot convince somebody that a dove is a symbol of the Holy Spirit if you don't first tell them what a dove is. That's just life. That's how it works. So you start out with the natural things, and then you can understand how they work in figurative use and things like that. And so we're in the Strong's Concordance. It is a walk, a way to follow, but we're going to take it back to its ancient form. Unfortunately, we have wingdings again. And in our midrash, I did explain what wingdings is. Okay, so if anybody doesn't know what wingdings are, you can catch me after the presentation. But it's from the root Yod Lamed Kaf. Yod Lamed Kaf. The Lamed and the Kaf up there in the heart of the word. I know you can't see this pointy, but the Lamed and the Kaf in the heart of the word is the father root, what we call the father root of the word. It contains the genetic information, okay, to produce an understanding of what the word means. And so it's at the heart of the word. So Yod Lamed Kaf, as we break this thing down, means to lead by the hand to train. To lead by the hand to train. So now we're getting a more concrete view of what is translated as walking in the Bible. How someone walks or their walk. Walk in the light, for example. We see walk in the light in the epistles of, the epistles of John, Yohanan, for example. Walk in the light. Do not walk in the darkness. Well, what does that mean? I mean, what does that mean to a religious person or a Western thinking person? You know, to wander around in some sort of oblivion and so forth? But there's a meaning to this concept. Because the idea of your walk, how you walk, is not a picture of a father having a son and tossing his son out in the field and says, figure out how to walk yourself. It's not throwing him out there and telling him to figure this thing out yourself. The idea of walk in Scripture, halakha, has a meaning. Is a father putting his hand on the head of his son, his firstborn in particular, and guiding him to the left, guiding him to the right, showing him. That's the way it was designed in the beginnings. Fathers teach the children. And do these things for how long? Forever. Teach these things to your children. And if you do that, then the last generation sees the same truths as the first generation, and truly the end is revealed out of the beginning. And so the idea is not for people to fend for themselves, but a father guiding a son. I remember being on a flight. I lived most of my life on planes and so forth, and so I'm on Airbus A320, and there's three seats here, there's three seats there, and I wear my tzitzit pretty much 24/7. I don't wear them in the shower and things like that, okay? But they're always with me, and they're always on, and it's not just because I look at them and I'm reminded, a constant reminder of the commandments of my God. Okay? But it's also the best witnessing tool you ever have in your life. Okay? No longer will you have to run around thinking of cute little sayings to people. You know, you got a giant size hole in your heart that only God can fit? Okay? You don't have to carry around pockets of chick tracks. Now, if you don't know what that is, then you're not old enough, I guess. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, especially at the airport, because I'm at the airport. All I got to do is stand there. Who's there? Glad you asked. And it's such a very simple thing. So I'm sitting in the plane as usual, and there's a lady and her husband and their three sons sitting behind them, their whole family. And she turns to me and she goes, "What's that?" So I'm describing what these things are, and you can tell she's very liberal-minded. Can I use that word? And she's starting to heat up as she goes. She's starting to boil, okay? And so finally she gets to the point where she says, "Well, we don't raise our family like that. We're not religious people. We don't indoctrinate our children with these religious concepts. Our children, our sons, pointing to sons, we allow them to be progressive, to think for themselves, to choose what they want to choose and make their own decisions." So I turned to the lady and I said, "Well, then what do we need you for?" Which she didn't appreciate very much, by the way. Okay, conversation kind of abruptly ended there. But the reality, this is not your walk. Scripturally, your walk is things passed down from one generation to the next. The ordinance says, "I pass them down to you." And this is the concept of how things are done. As a matter of fact, the firstborn son, this is several thousand years ago, the firstborn son was expected to take upon the profession of his father. It wasn't incumbent upon the second and the third and the fourth born son, but the firstborn son, it was expected he would take upon the profession of his father. He would do what his father did. And so he, in the anointing, in the bar mitzvah and so forth, when they'd lay their hands on the firstborn son, he would expected, after he did his thing at the bima and so forth and did the Torah service, he would take upon the profession of his father. And so generally speaking, when they were done with the Torah service for the bar mitzvah, he would close the scriptures, set them down and say, "Now I will be about my father's business." Okay, now that ought to sound familiar. Okay? Because someone else goes to Jerusalem with his parents. It just happens to be that he's between the 12th and the 13th year. It just happens to tell you, okay? Now, they do it on the 13th year. That is more of a modern thing, okay, as far as Judaism goes. It's more of a modern thing to be the actual 13th birthday. Because that idea of being somewhere between the 12th and the 13th year was something that many cultures were doing over the centuries. For thousands of years, it's been between those ages that basically someone, if you will, comes of age to where they can take on responsibilities and be held accountable and things like that. And so the scriptures just happen to tell us that Yeshua was 12 years old. If he was born in the fall and they're going into the city for Pesach, then he's what? About 12 and a half years old. He's just between the ages. And of course, you all know how the story goes. His parents kind of lose him and so forth. And then later on, when they ask him what he's been doing, what does he say? "Did you not know I will be about my father's business?" Because his father would have laid his hand on his head and he would have conferred his business upon him. And so we know what he did. And so generally when I have smaller groups of people, when I bring this up, I say, but when Yeshua said, "Do you not know I would be about my father's business? What father do you think he was talking about?" And everybody would raise their hand and say, "That father." Now that's our mistake. That's my whole point here of Agadah and Halakha, okay? Is that many religious systems are always trained from a Greek point of view. Things are either this or they're that. That's the way we're trained in America to think in Western cultures. Everything's either this, everything's either that. In just a couple of weeks, we're going to vote for a Democrat or a Republican. We're going to have to choose this one or we're going to have to choose that one. Okay? And the whole system is set up to give us a choice between those two. That's just the Western way of thinking. And so we have a tendency to lean one way or the other, because the reality is that he really did physically take upon the profession of his father, did he not? But he also was taking on the profession of that father. So in Hebrew thinking, as I hope to conclude here with the Halakha Agadah thing, is it's going to be both. Two are designed to be one. From the very beginning, our Father has been in the business of taking things that man divides and bringing them back into oneness, because that's the witness that you have to have for something to be true. In order for something to be true, how many witnesses do we have to have? Two or more. But those witnesses, surprise, surprise, have to agree. If the witnesses don't agree, you don't have truth. And I'm just proposing to you for one example. We could do this all day. But one example, of course, is that for quite some time now, we've had the house of Israel producing one witness and the house of Judah producing another one. And they have not agreed with each other. And we have not been producing truth to the world. It's only when the two become one. So the Father's in the business of restoring and reuniting and gathering the two to make them one fold, one flock, one in His hand. Because then we will be expressing truth to the world. The same is true in your marriages. Males and females are totally different things. That is absolutely true. And some of you know that. And not just your plumbing, okay? But there's some other things about us that are a little different. Okay? Men are from Mars. Okay, I won't do that. But anybody who experiences a marriage more than, oh, say, 15 minutes, okay, clearly understands that we in many ways are different kind of human beings. But we're designed to be one. And I say that because people, it is quite obvious that the Torah and grace are two different things. But their design, I'm trying to press upon you, to be one. And this is expressed not just scripturally, I believe, but in the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. These things are revealed in the natural things of creation. The idea is to pass things down from one generation to the next. So this is the things that are demonstrated on the outside. Halakha, without going into all the definitions, because we don't have time, is something that's expressed out here. That's what halakha is all about. What you do. If I'm walking down the street, I am demonstrating something to you. You can see me walking down the street. It's something everybody can see. Of course, we all know that your walk is really actually speaking of your life, isn't it? How you walk is how you live your life. But how you live your life, based scripturally, is the Father's passing these things down to the children. I know I'm going to insult some teachers here, and they're really hard workers, but the education of our kids were designed to be from our parents. And it's just another opportunity to turn them over to the system. And I know there's some hard-working teachers, please don't be insulted, that we need to support, that are working in the system, and you're doing the very best you can. But I'm afraid that was not our Father's original design. It was to be passed down from the fathers to the children. And it's no coincidence that when I was young, I never heard the word homeschooling. When I was back in the 50s and 60s, you know, as a child, if I'd have seen some kid riding his bike down the street, and I was at recess at school, and I go, what are you doing? How come you're not in school? I'm homeschooled. Where can I get into that? How can I get a hold of that, buddy? Because he's out riding his bike. So, okay? Everybody want to do that? But that's the way it was designed in the first place. We've got to move along. Got a lot of things to do. Now that is halakha. Halakha, in other words, what you see on the outside, the things you see and are demonstrated are halakha, how you walk. But there's another way of thinking in the first century. As I said yesterday, halakha and agadah are not just words that have meaning in Scripture, but they're also two different ways of thinking. Sometimes, as Joe Good mentioned the other day, the house of Hillel would be thinking one way, or the house of Shammai would be thinking another way, and they're all trying to, you know, head toward the same direction, but it's a thinking process. And one involves what's going on the outside, one involves what's going on the inside. We have a tendency to think of Judaism as, oh, they just do all the outward stuff, and we Christians do all the inward stuff. When in reality, that's been true in Judaism from time immemorial. They've understood those kind of things. Sometimes, obviously, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, they get a bad rap sometimes. They're not all the same, and we do them an injustice by painting them all with the same brush. Because they're not all like that. Guess what? Judaism is not monolithic. Christianity is not monolithic. The Hebrew roots walk is not monolithic. It's not just one stone. You can't have somebody say, well, Judaism says, which Judaism, dude? Okay? Christianity teaches, which one? Okay? And now we have Hebrew roots teaches, which one? Because there's lots of variety within the kind, if you will. Let's talk about as much as Agadah as we can. If you look at it downstream, it is Aleph, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. Ag, Gadah. You say the Gimel twice, if you will. Agadah. Now, if you look it up in the Strong's, it says to narrate, to tell, in front of, opposite, declare, and show. You still get a lot more abstract definitions. That's my contention about the language and why the Father is turning the pure language back to the people, not to the pinheads. Okay? Our system for 2,000 years has been run by pinheaded theologians and pointy-headed intellectuals. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question, which means you don't have to answer it. Of all the things that divide us in the body of Messiah, of all the things that separate us that we debate and argue over in the last 2,000 years, how many of these debates have these guys solved? Da, 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 da. The answer is none. And I'm going to suggest to you that they probably caused more problems than they solved. So that's why the prophecy is he's going to turn the pure language back to the people. And that's one of the things that the Father is doing in the universe right now. That's another whole story. But as we take this word back, which turned out to be winged knees again, it's based upon Nun Gimel Dalet. Nun Gimel Dalet. Which actually first appears, because we're not going to have time to do it, as the helpmate for Adam. This word that's a way of thinking, okay, in Judaism, this word that means to narrate, to tell something. When you, a lot of you are familiar with this word because when you sit down in Pesach and you have your Seder and you have everything lined out, you have these pieces of paper or you have a little book in front of you, which is a Passover Haggadah, right? That's the same word. That's you read that and it tells you. It declares something from here. It's the hearts of the... That's the purpose of Malachi chapter 4 in the latter days, is the hearts of the fathers will return to the children and the hearts of the children will go back to the fathers. And so that's why all of a sudden you got millions of people across the earth observing Pesach, where the fathers sit down at the table with their children. Not the public school system. The fathers sit down with the children at the Passover table and they... From their hearts they declare unto the children what these things are all about. So it's directly related to what comes forth from here to declare and to tell. Because in classic Judaism, we don't have time to go through all the rabbinic quotes, they understand that Agadah is a matter of the heart. To begin here, you always have to begin in the heart. That's how our Father begins with us. He starts in the heart first. And once He's restored our heart, because He's a Papa, because He's a Father, He now knows, now I can deal with your mind. Now I can deal with my children's thinking process. Now we're thinking differently. Many of us are. I mean, literally raise your hands. How many of you are thinking and seeing the Scriptures differently in the last 5 or 10 years than you did all the rest of your life? Yes, testimony after testimony of people seeing these things, because this is how the Father is working. Malachi chapter 4 does not say that let me say it in the negative. The Father says He's going to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children. Now, when I was a regular pastor dude many years ago, I thought that meant my dad. I thought it was talking about my dad. Oh, the heart of my dad's going to be restored to me. And I said, everything's okay with my father. He's going to be here someday. Okay, everything's okay. But then I realized, no. He's talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those fathers' hearts will be turned back to the children, and the hearts of the children will be restored back to the fathers. And Luke chapter 1:17 quotes that, if you remember. But he does a midrash on it. If you will. He doesn't quote it precisely. Why does he not quote it precisely? Because this is the Hebrew way. Only Greeks would have to dot every I and cross every T. It's not the thinking process. When Yeshua was speaking, there was not a Greek stenographer sitting on a rock taking notes, asking him to back up because he missed that last comment and things like that. They would memorize these things. They would listen to the rabbi. They listened to their teacher. And they put these things to heart. Many of them would put them to song. Now, why would they put the words of the rabbi into a song? Anybody that sings ought to know what I'm talking about. Because it's easier to memorize when it has a meter and a flow to these things. And so, this is the hearts of the Father. So, I realized that when I went to Sunday school and when I was even in the Bible school and things like that, when I went there, I learned things about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with going to school and learning about the little stories of Noah and the jawbone of the donkey or whatever, you know. That's okay. But I realized that I learned things about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I was young. But now the Father is teaching us the hearts of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the promise is that when we learn the hearts. Now, how do we learn the hearts of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? All of a sudden, all across the world, millions of people like you and here are doing the weekly Torah portions. Never did that when you were in Sunday school. That was all done away with. Okay? But now, all of a sudden, multitudes of people are learning and following the weekly Torah portions. And what are you reading about when you read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy? You learn about the fathers. And now we're beginning to learn not just things they did, but now we're learning the hearts of our father Abraham. And the promise was is that our hearts have returned back to them. But see, those children that are spoken about in Malachi chapter 4, as to the identity of who they are, is revealed in Luke chapter 1 verse 17. Because in speaking of John the Baptist, which is Elijah, he quotes Malachi chapter 4. Luke does. And he quotes the passages, and hear what he says. Here's what he says. The hearts of the fathers will be turned back to the children, and the children of disobedience will return back to the wisdom of the just. The children of those who are disobedient will turn back to the wisdom of the just. Now, is that what Malachi chapter 4 says? No, it says the hearts of the children will be turned back to the fathers. But Luke gives you information as to who those children are. They're disobedient. They turned away. And so he was going to restore them back to the wisdom of the just. Who has the wisdom of the just? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But this all bears forth from the heart. Everything comes forth from here. Even this word alone expresses the idea of the things of life are learned, are ripened, weaned at the door. Which is literally when you break down Nagad, Nun, Gimel, Dalet, that's what it means. It's a concrete thing that everybody experiences every day in life. That's why when you read Deuteronomy 30, it says you don't have to go over land and sea and over here there to know the Word of God. Where is it? It's nigh unto your lips. It's right in front of your face. Where? In the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. That's where the fathers reveal all these. But we ignore those things and we allow evolutionary teaching to come along and pervert us into thinking that those things weren't that way in the beginning. They evolved over billions of years to be that way. And we wonder why we dice up the Word of God like a frog in a biology lab. It's because we've been duped into thinking that everything is evolving. When according to the laws, the known laws, things are going downhill, my friends, not uphill. Things are going the other way. So the Father, because He knows things are going the other way, what does He constantly have to do for every generation? Because He loves the entire world. He's got to restore things all the time. Because if He doesn't, we would have disappeared into a puff of smoke a long time ago. But thank goodness, according to Isaiah chapter 1 verse 8, our Father always has a little remnant of His people. And that's why it goes on to say, so we don't go up like Sodom and Gomorrah, is because of the remnant. I pray and understand, of course, that much of the remnant is sitting here in this auditorium right now. But why? What the whole thing of life being weaned to the door is because in normal cultures back then, which is where the Father puts the meaning of His words in the normal things we do, a lot of the activity took place at the door of the home. The most important concept in of the house and the land and the piece of land, the house, the family, and the piece of land was the house. The most important part of the house was the door. Because that was the way in, of course, and the way out. And the Father was responsible to stand at that door. And He was the one that was to protect His family and watch over them and take care of them. He's the one that was supposed to stand at the door and go, "You ain't getting in, dude." Okay? He's the one that allowed or disallowed what was going to infect His family in the home. That was His responsibility. A lot of conversations took place at the door. That's why the elders in the big cities and so forth, when they had walls around them, sat at the narrow gates in the big cities and gave counsel and so forth. Because it was the way into the city. So that's where the elders sat. That's where they gave counsel at those places. They also, did you know, relieved debts. They were allowed to relieve debts. Okay? So if you relieved your debt at the narrow gate, you could walk in freedom in the city. If you had debts and a lot of vendors and so forth in the city you owed a lot of money to and you didn't pay them, you know they'd come and take you out. Okay? Today we say they'd whack them. Okay? Because you owe debts to everybody in the city. But you could go to the narrow gate, okay, where the elders sat in the narrow gate, and you could pay those debts there. And then when you walk through that narrow gate, you could walk in freedom of the city. Now, you could do that, or you say, I don't want to pay my debts, and you can walk in the wide gate with all every other Tom, Dick, and Slomo, okay? And you can walk through the gate in fear. You can walk through there in fear all of your life, or you can settle your debts now and walk in freedom. I'm not going to elaborate on that right now, but I want you to understand the importance of these things took place at the door. That was still true in our country, even up to the 50s and 60s, if you remember Leave It to Beaver. 6:30 in the morning, there's June, with her white dress and her pearls and so forth, and her hair all done up there, standing at the door, 6:30 in the morning, we all look like that, okay? And down the stairs comes the Beav, okay, and Wally's lumbering behind them and so forth, and they have their little sack lunches in school and so forth, and they'd have conversations about their day, and June would be there when they return home. A lot of activity took place at the door. That is where the declaring and the telling and so forth took place. This is something that happens everywhere. I want to give you a couple of rabbinic quotes. Why? Because every rabbinic quote means that what I'm saying is true? No. A lot of us quote the rabbis, and there's nothing wrong with that. Okay? I have a purpose of quoting the rabbis. I quote the rabbis when the rabbis agree with me. Okay? But and in reality, most all of us do that. There are two kinds of people in the world, those who admit it and those who don't. But sometimes we lull people into thinking that what we're saying is true just because we have a rabbinic quote up there. I quote them because I want because I study, as many other people here do, the way they think. Okay? Because they are the one that maintain the scriptures and the Torah. So I want to know how they think and so forth. And so it's just like when you write a dissertation, when you go to some university and you're getting your PhD and you're going through your thesis and so forth, and you got to have all the resources quoted, right? When you get done, you got to have all those sources of where you got that stuff at, which actually subtly lulls the readers into thinking that what you're saying must be true because you quoted these sources, right? But in reality, all it really proves is that you found somebody that agrees with you. That's really all you've done. I'm just trying to, you know, think realistically here. So I quote these things because they understand that Agadah and Halakha together enable the mystic soul to live concretely. To live concretely. Together they lead inexorably to heavenly days upon the earth. These two ways of thinking were not designed to be separated any more than male and female are designed to be separated. They were designed to be one. Only then can you have peace and oneness. Now I'm going to do these. Rabbi Nachman Krochmeyer, let me quote him as well. The essential subject matter of Agadah is the focusing and direction of what? The heart. That's where our Papa starts, is the heart. Then he works with our mind. Right now I'm going to propose to you that for 2,000 years, Yeshua has been restoring men's hearts. For 2,000 years, restoring our hearts first. Then at a particular time, sovereignly known to him and him alone, he began to start restoring his people's minds. And that's what we're all going through right now, is the restoration of our minds. He's doing that because one day, he will simply cry out to his people, come home. And then our bodies are prepared to go there now, aren't they? Because that's the only thing left. Restore the heart, restore the mind, restore our behavior. Because I'm just going to propose to you that our Father knows the nature of His creation. And I believe He sovereignly knows that if He would have done this 50 years ago, we would not have gone. Our minds were not prepared to go 50 years ago. And some of you are thinking to yourself, well, thank goodness He didn't do this 50 years ago. He's doing it exactly according to His timing. We all know that. Because He's preparing His people for something that we actually are going to physically have to be involved in. So He prepares our hearts and then He prepares our mind. Very quickly, I want to give you several forms of what we call Midrash. On the left-hand side of your screen is Halakha, which I have summed up in the phrase instructions. Okay? So when they write the commandments on the stones, those are the instructions. That is how you behave. First several instructions, your behavior toward your God. The last instructions of behavior between yourselves, your fellow man. And so these are instructions on how to behave. Agadah is relationship. Relationships are born forth from the heart. They come forth from here, my friends. That is where the Father always begins. And so from a holic point of view, now as we go through these very quickly, I want you to see it's not choose one of these. That's what we're traditionally trained to do in Greek thinking. Choose one or the other. How many times have I been in the land? How many times have I been in the land and talking to a sabra, talking to Israeli in the streets and so forth, and just after a few minutes of conversation with him, because if your love for him is at the core of your heart, it can't help but come up in the conversation. It's difficult to just talk about sports. Okay, you know what I mean? I mean, eventually you're going to be sharing the same thing. And how many times have I had them tell me, you know, you need to choose. You need to choose between the Messiah, your Messiah. No, this is the way you say it. You need to choose between your Jesus or the Torah. And then I'm talking to some of my Christian friends. I'm in Texas or Oklahoma, where I'm at. And I say the same thing, have the same kind of conversation. What do they say to me? They say, you need to choose between Jesus and the Torah. They both say the same thing. Okay? Choose between these two. And I'm proposing to you that the two are designed to be one. Okay? So don't think of these as a contrast. Because they're both true. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. They're both true. From a halakhic point of view, the words of God are seen as how to walk, which is demonstrated out here. From an agadic point of view, is how to rejoice. Let me give you an example. The dancers up here. Tim and Angie and Chad and all the people that are leading you into dance. I know I have some people out. They're showing you how to do the moves. That's halakha. So we have the man dance that we're going to do. We're going to practice again this afternoon. And they're going to get out there and they're going to show us, Tim, how to move this foot. That's halakha. Here's the instructions of what to do. Here's our view of how to do it, and you do this. But I can't teach you, Chad can't teach you, Tim can't teach you how to rejoice. That's got to come forth from here. That's got to be born out of a relationship with the Almighty. And it's not something I can teach you how to do. My dad went out into the field and he taught me how to play baseball. He said, hold the bat this way, slide into second that way, do this, do that. But my father could not teach me compassion, dedication, and commitment. You can't teach that to someone. It's got to be a gift from God, and not of work, good works, if you will. Okay? It's got to be born forth from here. Now that I have it here, it's much easier for my dad to tell me how to do this. Tim, Angie, I'm sure you would agree that if you know that the people you have to come to practice are dedicated, committed, and compassionate in what they do, boy, it's easy to teach them to dance then. Okay? The dancing comes out first, it's born here, then it's out here. A couple more examples. Because these are both true, is my point. From a halakhic point of view, God's word is seen as might and power, parting of the seas, roaring waves, and so on and so forth. All this stuff is true. And His word is revealed in those things, but it's also seen in grace and love. See, might and power you can see. It can be demonstrated. Does it sound like I'm yelling at y'all? Okay, sometimes I think I'm yelling at them. Mind and power is something that's demonstrated, and it's very much God, okay? It's very much our Redeemer and our Creator. But grace and love is something you can't see. That's what Agadah is all about. It's something you can't see because it's in here. It's where the seed goes. The seed of the woman goes in here. The seed doesn't go in here. Seed doesn't go in here. The seed's planted in the very heart. That's why the garden is in the very heart, okay, and so forth. Technically at the east end of the garden, but I believe it was the heart of the universe. That's Brad's weird opinion. You don't have to agree with that, okay? But both are true. It's not choose might or power or choose grace and love. They're both true. Another example, the voice of power, the sound of many rushing waters, as I mentioned earlier. But He also speaks in what? A still small voice. So if you go out in the ocean and so place and you can hear the roar of the waves, that's halakha, if you will. That's demonstration of something. It's God's halakha. He's demonstrating something to you. But then a still small voice is something you can't see. Some of us, as I believe, our Father has been, always does, speaks to us in a still small voice. I think he's always doing it, but I think the enemy comes in because the enemy knows that the Father speaks to us in a still small voice. So he's always about the business of cluttering up our lives with noise. Whether it be iPods or iPads or cell phones beeping and bopping and banging and dinging and bing bong bing tring bing, they got all these noises going on in our life, and our papa's trying to talk to us. And the enemy fills our life up with noise. I think Yeshua understood that. Even 2,000 years ago, he said, "Hey, gang, excuse me, but I need to go off by myself for a while. I need to get away from the crowd of the multitudes around me, or the noise of the multitudes, and go a place and just pray to my Father and be quiet so I can listen to His voice." Especially as a demonstration, at least, of how that's done. Okay? Sometimes what we do up here is tiring. Am I right, Joe? Sometimes I would rather dig ditches for 8 hours, okay? No, I love this letter of the Torah. So the Halakah is revealed in the phrase letter of the Torah. It also can be seen in the phrase, the concept of body and truth. We have teaching somebody in spirit and in truth. The idea is the two are designed to be one, not choose the spirit or choose the truth. Those two are designed to be one. Paul did not teach in Corinthians to choose between the letter of the Torah or choose the spirit of the Torah. I'm going to just give you a little phrase here. I hope it resonates with some people. I'm going to propose to you that it's not a choice. It's not one or the other. It's one before the other. It's not one or the other. It's one before the other. Because that's how everything works in nature. You can't have fruit without a seed. You can't produce fruit in the field until you first plant the seed. It's not, well, I choose the fruit. No, I choose the seed. No, first plant the seed, then produce the fruit. That's the reality of how the natural things of creation works. But we're trained always to choose one of the other. Oh, I would like to go into this in more detail. I don't have time. The brain and the conscience. Another example. The brain is something you can see. Brain surgeons can cut open your skull and there's the gray matter right there. And you have to have that. That's the something that's seen. But then there's a thing called the conscience, something that is unseen. Something that brain surgeons will admit they know a whole lot of things about the mechanics of your brain, but they still don't fully understand what makes a person long for something. Where does longing come from? Where does mourning come from? Where does joy? Where does that elation? Where does that puppy dog feeling when you fall in love with that first girl, guys? We can't really see the mechanics of how that works in the brain. Okay? But see, you can't, it's not one or the other. It's not choose the conscience. See, the Father doesn't need your brain to talk to you. Did you know that? Our Father doesn't need sinews, skin, hair, bones, all that kind of stuff. He doesn't need any of that to communicate with His people. He can do it on a level that doesn't need any of that. So then why do we have all that? To communicate with each other. To be able to experience and relate with each other, that's why we have all the hair and the skin and the bones, all of it, because He certainly does not need it. So in order for us to communicate with each other, we need the gray matter up here. So it's not one or the other, it's both. If you have a conscience, but do not have a brain, you have no way of expressing it. Okay? If you have a brain and have no conscience, then you're like a senator or a congressman or something like that, okay? But you gotta have both, is the point. If we can even see the seven churches in Asia, for example, there's four clear views of what those churches are all about. I can test you that all four of them are true. Okay? We can talk about that another time. But what do? We're trained from a Greek system, so we choose one of the four and we write terrible books about the other three. That's the way we're designed to do things. Okay? Now that I've figured out that I'm right and everybody else is wrong, now I'm going to say terrible things about everybody else's view. Okay? And you expect people to listen to you so you can get somewhere out of just chewing out your dog in the backyard. Okay? Brain conscious. Couple more things. Hurry, Brad. Fruit, seed. There's another example. It's not choose the fruit, choose a seed. Keep the commandments or the testimony of Yeshua. Is that the contrast that we're given? Either keep the commandments or have the testimony of Yeshua. Or is it those who kept the commandments and had the testimony of Yeshua? Okay? Is it both or is it choose one? It's not one or the other. Is it choose between the Old Testament and the New Testament? Okay? Or are the two designed to be one book? Is that one book written unto us? Knowing about God and knowing God. Huge difference between knowing things about God and knowing God. Moses, of all the people, Moses was the only one. You think about it. To some people's estimates, possibly 3 to 6 million Israelites wandered in the wilderness. Let's take the low view. 3 million. 3 million Israelites wandering throughout the wilderness. Only one did God trust His commandments to. Moses. Didn't give it to the others, did he? He gave it to Moses. Only one person he was entrusted with his commandments, and that happens to be the only person in the Bible that it said that he knew the ways of God. He knew, yada. He knew the ways of God. The psalmist says that the children of Israel knew his acts. Halakha. They were all impressed with all the demonstrations. Look at this, look at that, look at this. But Moses knew him intimately. He knew him panim al panim. He knew him face to face. And he's the only one that knew his ways. There's a lot of those who saw his face and so on and so forth like that. He's the only one that knew the ways of God. So the only one that had that relationship with him, especially after they did the calf worship thing and broke that and so forth, the only one that had that relationship with him, we see, was Moses. And so that's the only one he entrusted his commandments to, was the only one that had a relationship with him. I do not think that is insignificant. And I think when the batteries fall out of your widget here, that's significant. Okay, never mind. So there's a difference between knowing things about God and knowing God. Many of us were raised in a religious system where we know things about God, but that's not the same as knowing Him. That's a relationship thing. A couple more things very quickly. We're not going to do that one. Love your neighbor, love your God. When they was asked that question about the religious powers that be, did he say choose one or the other? Did he say choose to love your God or choose to love your neighbor? Did he say one or the other, or did he say one before the other? He say to love Yahweh your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. He said one before the other. He didn't say choose one of those two. Same with word and deed. According to the book of Ephesians, when your word matches your deed, then you have truth. When the two become one, then you have truth. Outside of the cup, inside the cup. Speaking to the powers that be, he says, you tithe of mint and cumin and anise. Now that's halakha. That's in the Torah. That's what we're supposed to do. You tithe of mint and cumin and anise. So that's something demonstrated. You can see them coming to the temple. Why am I doing this? Anyway, you can see them coming to the temple with all the mint and cumin and anise and offerings in their hands. You could see that demonstrated. But he says, you omit the weightier matters of the Torah, which is what? Judgment, mercy, and faith. Those are three things you can't see. Okay? Three things you can't see are called the weightier matters, according to Yeshua. And he didn't stop there. He didn't stop there. He said, clean first the inside of the cup, that the outside may be clean also. Did he say choose the inside of the cup or choose the outside of the cup? No, he said, clean first the inside, that the outside may be clean also. And I'm going to do one more very quickly, okay? Something naturally that everybody sees in the universe. Mothers raising children. Mothers having babies in their arms. Because Agadah is the baby. Halakha is the youth or the adult. Everybody starts out as babies. Nobody starts out as adults. But it's not choose one or the other as well. But ladies, I'm going to confer to you right now. When you're holding that baby in your arms, and you're goo-goo and gaga and you're smooching and so forth, do you turn to that two-week-old baby and you go, now you have to be in by 11 o'clock every night. Now on Saturday you can stay out till 12, but I'm telling you, by 11 o'clock, do you do that? Do you give them pile a bunch of rules on them? No, what are you doing when you're doing that? You're establishing a relationship first. That's why the baby has to trust you as he's nestled in your arms to establish that relationship. Then when the baby gets to be a little older, it's a toddler, now it's crawling around the floor, right? Okay, now it's moving about and having some of its own mind, and it's eating everything in sight, matted hair on the carpeting and suckers and so forth. It's eating everything. It's like a Christian. I can eat anything now. But then when it gets to the steps and about to plummet 12 feet to its death, you say, whoa. You put a little fence there. Some of you put an actual fence up, don't you? On the stairs, okay? You say, whoa, that's as far as you go. But you didn't do that when it was 2 weeks old. This is the whole background of the Council of Acts chapter 15 and the whole thing. And I said 3 hours worth of stuff in about 50 minutes.